the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Who remembers where we left off in Genesis? It's been about 2 months. Anybody remember where we left off? Talking about Jacob and Esau. In the middle of chapter 25, which is what we last finished, in the middle of that chapter, we transitioned from the account of God's dealings with Abraham to the account of his dealings with his grandsons, Esau and Jacob. The storyteller, in fact, actually skips over Isaac. Everything, and there's not a lot, but everything we read about Isaac is either inserted into Abraham's story or it's inserted into the story of his sons. So today we'll look at chapter 26. And this whole chapter is one of those insertions of Isaac's story into someone else's. And its being here might seem a little odd. We started into Jacob and Esau. Why are we going back to Isaac? The last thing we read was the story of Esau selling his birthright to Jacob for that pot of stew. Suddenly now, after that, the storyteller takes us back in time to a time before Esau and Jacob were even born and spends almost an entire chapter, 33 out of 35 verses, spends almost that entire chapter summarizing the adult life of Isaac. The reason why Isaac's life is mostly inserted as an interlude into the story of Esau and Jacob is important. It explains why this is here and why it's important to us. I want to address that in our conclusion, though. First, I want to look at Isaac's story itself. What is here? So this is chapter 26. Now, the first thing we'll notice about Isaac's story is that it could almost be read as if it were a summary of Abraham's life. As we read through this, think about Abraham. It could almost be Abraham's life. Almost. The events of Isaac's life run parallel to the events in his father's life. We've already seen this in chapter 25 where we read about the birth of Esau and Jacob. Remember, that was not the last time we were in Genesis, but the time before that. The story started by telling us that Rebekah had been barren, infertile for 20 years. We're reminded immediately of Sarah, Abraham's wife, who was barren for 25 years. And yet, where it took 9 chapters to resolve the problem of Sarah's barrenness, here in Isaac's story, the storyteller deals with Rebekah's barrenness in one verse. It's resolved. It's his way of telling us all that heartache, all that anxiety that Sarah and Abraham went through for 25 years on account of their childlessness. Yes, Isaac and Rebekah dealt with all of that too. Same thing in their childlessness. Sorry. It's sort of like a literary ditto. And that becomes the pattern of how that story in Genesis tells us about Isaac in his life. And we see this go on in chapter 26. Like Abraham, Isaac faces a famine. Like Abraham, Isaac decides to go to Egypt. Like Abraham, Isaac gets into trouble in Gerar with Abimelech for lying about his wife being his sister. Like Abraham, Isaac gets into disputes over the wells he digs. Like Abraham, Isaac receives God's promises and then builds an altar to worship him. Like Abraham, Isaac makes a treaty with Abimelech. Everything Abraham does, Isaac does. But there's a reason that Isaac's story is told this way. We see very clearly that God's plan has not changed. He's leading Isaac down the same covenant path that he had previously led Abraham. God is the same. His promises are the same. So with that, we should expect chapter 26 begins on a familiar note. There's a famine in the land. Have we heard that before? Now, there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. So notice the parallel here already with Abraham's action. Abraham faced famine. What did he do? He went to Egypt. Now, famines were a pretty common thing in Palestine. And so Isaac, experiencing yet another famine, he picks up and he heads to Egypt too. just as his father had done, just like anybody else would have done. It was a common sense thing to do. Egypt was where the food was. They've got this nice river that floods every year and brings fresh silt to the crops. They don't have very many famines in Egypt. So everybody's going there. But see, Isaac isn't everybody. Isaac isn't just anyone else. He had a reason to stay in Canaan despite the famine. And he should have known better. His father got into trouble when he left the promised land to find bread in Egypt. And if you think back to the story where Abraham sent his servant out to get the bride for Isaac, what did he make really clear to his servant? If the girl doesn't want to come here, just leave her be. Do not, under any circumstances, take my son from Canaan back to Paddan Aram. My son stays here. He doesn't go to where we came from. Abraham made it really clear. Isaac needed to stay in the land of promise. And I'm sure that he must have reiterated that to Isaac directly. This is the land God promised. We need to stay here. So Isaac should have known better. He packs up and starts heading south. On the way, he stops in this place called Gerar. This is the same place where Abraham had lived for some time. In fact, the king at that time had given Abraham the right to pasture his flocks in his territory. So this is a familiar place. Now, Isaac gets there, and he has dealings with a guy named Abimelech, just like Abraham had. Now, that's not the same guy necessarily. In fact, the time frame we're looking at, it's almost impossible. Abimelech just means my father is king. It was probably a title for the king of Gerar, like Pharaoh was the title for the king of Egypt, or it may have been a dynastic name. All of the kings adopted this name, Abimelech. Whatever the case, he's following in his father's footsteps. And it's while Isaac is in Gerar that God intervenes and makes sure he doesn't go any further toward Egypt. The text goes on and says, "The Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws.'" So again, going to Egypt for food was the natural thing to do. But God has other plans for Isaac. Isaac was looking at the natural. God was planning the supernatural. And so he calls Isaac to remain in the land of promise despite the famine. It's something of a test of faith. And then God uses this call to faith as an opportunity to make a formal restatement to Isaac of his covenant and his promises and his blessings. Up to this point, it was God's covenant with Abraham. Now he makes it his covenant with Isaac. Notice, if you look at the text, he says, "I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham, your father." And now it transfers to Isaac. "I will multiply your offspring, and I will give to your offspring these lands. And in your, Isaac, in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." So Isaac's sort of the new Abraham now. He's the one who's carrying God's promises. Everything that was promised to Abraham is now promised personally to him. So God's calling Isaac to walk with him in faith, just as his father had. And yet, God doesn't call his people to follow him blindly. He shows us his past faithfulness as reason to trust him. In fact, that's part of the whole structure of this story, why it parallels Abraham's story. God is teaching Isaac, and he's communicating to us as well his faithfulness. But in restating the covenant to Isaac, he doesn't just restate the covenant blessing. You remember, he promised blessing to Abraham, but he also told Abraham, "You've got your end of this deal as well. You have your obligations in this covenant." He had told Abraham, "Walk before me and be blameless." Here, God essentially says the same thing to Isaac, but instead of saying, Isaac, walk before me and be blameless, he says, remember that those obligations I gave your dad? You do that too. You do what he did. And then he says what Abraham did. He says, Isaac, Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. This is God's way of telling Isaac what his end of the deal is. And it's hard to understate just how significant this statement from God is. This is where God explains what it looks like to walk before him and to be blameless. It means doing what he says, and more importantly, it means, as he says, keeping his charge, his commandments, his statutes, his laws. This is almost exactly the same language that Moses uses in Deuteronomy 11, where God tells the Israelites, you shall therefore love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his rules, and his commandments always. See, Deuteronomy was the place where the new generation of Israelites, after the old ones who had been afraid to enter Canaan because they feared the giants there, they wandered in the wilderness until they all died off. Now the new generation is ready to go in. And so Moses restates God's covenant to them. Deuteronomy sort of means the second giving of the law. So he told them, after giving them the law, keep his charge, his statutes, his rules, his commandments always. Now consider, God gave that law, those commandments, charges, statutes, through Moses when the people were gathered around Mount Sinai. In our Bibles, it's pages and pages and pages of instructions, all that boring stuff. People try to read the Bible through in a year, and that's where they always get stuck and stop. Pages and pages of thou shalt and thou shalt not, shalt nots, are all summed up by God in these words. You love me, and love me by keeping my charges, my statutes, my rules, my commandments. Now what's remarkable here is that God tells Isaac that Abraham had already done all this with no direct knowledge of the law, without all those pages and pages and pages of thou shalt and thou shalt nots. The point is that Abraham obeyed that law from his heart. Because Abraham walked with God, he knew God. And he knew what was pleasing to God. And because he desired to please God, he did those things that he knew to be pleasing. Abraham exemplifies the ideal for God's people. By faith, the law is in our hearts. Think of God's promise. It was made through Jeremiah. He was looking toward the time when the Messiah would come. And he told them, he said, this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. He says, I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me. From the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. So the Messiah would come and bring forgiveness of sins, and through faith in him, this ideal situation would come where the law was simply in the hearts of his people. Through the Messiah, men and women would know the Lord. They would be in fellowship with God. That's the ideal that was anticipated with the coming of Christ. And yet we see that ideal right here in Abraham. As God says to Isaac, he obeyed me. The point God makes to Isaac is that faith makes obedience possible. Faith gives us a desire to please God, even when we don't have the pages and pages and pages of thou shalt and thou shalt nots. Faith creates in us the desire to please God through obedience. So Abraham lived by faith and obeyed God. He kept the law, even though he lived long before it was written on those stone tablets. God had written it on his heart. But you know, even Moses could tell the people before they went into Canaan in Deuteronomy 30, he could tell them, this commandment that I command you today, it's not too hard for you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you can do it. It's in your heart because of faith. St. Paul looked back to that same passage from Deuteronomy, and he says in Romans that the word that Moses said was in your heart, in our hearts. That's the word of faith that he was proclaiming to them. So to walk with God in faith is to know him. And to know him is to desire to please him. Faith desires obedience, and that same faith makes obedience possible. So in calling Isaac to stay in the promised land despite the famine, God isn't just calling him to a legalistic obedience. God isn't saying, stay here because I said so. He's calling Isaac to real faith, to something deeper. So God is asking Isaac to trust him. Obedience is then the natural outgrowth of trust, because in trusting God to provide, we stop trusting in ourselves and we give our problems to him. Our whole lives into the hands of God, and we let him take care of things. So Isaac obeys, and as we'll see in a few verses, God provides. But first, we see that Isaac's faith and his obedience are not perfect. Just as Abraham had, Isaac makes some mistakes. So look at verses 6 to 11. So Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, oops. He said, she is my sister. Sound familiar? For he feared to say my wife, thinking lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, she is your wife. How then can you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, because I thought lest I die because of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? Just as his father had, Isaac feared that he might be killed by men who were interested in his beautiful wife. So just as Abraham did, Isaac lies to the men of Gerar, saying that Rebekah is his sister. Now Isaac and Rebekah get away with their ruse, apparently, for what it says is a long time. But one day, Abimelech looks out his window and he sees the two of them together. Now to understand what it's saying here, remember, the name Isaac, what does Isaac mean? Laughter, that's right. So he looks out the window and he sees Isaac laughing with his wife. It's a euphemism. They were doing something intimate. Not sure exactly what, but it's something only a husband and wife would do. Abimelech catches Isaac being himself, is what the text is basically saying. He looks out the window and he sees Isaacing with Rebekah. And, of course, Abimelech is outraged. Someone might have believed the lies and taken Rebekah adulterously. And adultery was a very serious offense, even amongst the pagans in that culture. So thank God it hadn't happened so far, but the possibility was there. And ironically, it's the pagan king who fears God and lives righteously, in contrast to Isaac, whom God has called to walk in faith and obedience, but who has been living a lie. It's funny, the story about Jacob and Esau centers around masks, people pretending to be who they aren't. And it sort of starts here with Isaac. Isaac pretends he's not Isaac until Abimelech catches Isaacing with his wife. It's going to come up later with Jacob and with Esau. So just as his father had done, Isaac puts God's promises in jeopardy because he's dishonest. You know, what happens if someone takes Rebekah? Now, Isaac, how's he going to have these children through whom the promise is going to come? But God providentially rescues the situation, and God continues to bless Isaac. So it's encouraging to know that God doesn't abandon us, doesn't abandon his people because we make mistakes. Isaac was unfaithful when it came to the lies about his wife, but he did obey God's command to remain in the land of promise. And he planted crops. He was a shepherd, but shepherds did this sometimes. He planted crops, And God blessed him with, it says, a hundredfold return. In fact, God blessed Isaac so greatly, adding to the wealth that he had inherited from Abraham, that the people of Gerar started to see him as a threat. Look at verses 12 to 16. Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." So again, Isaac's walking the same path that his dad did. What God had promised to Abraham is fulfilled in Isaac's life. But having been asked to leave by Abimelech, Isaac moves his camp and he resettles in this nearby region, this valley, where Abraham had pastured his flocks years before. And apparently Isaac was powerful enough that he posed a real threat to Abimelech. But you notice neither Abraham nor Isaac is ever willing to seize the promised land by force. Even when he went and rescued Lot and defeated Chedorlaomer, and he could claim by right all of this territory that Chedorlaomer had just conquered. No, force was not the way to do it. And that's in very stark contrast to how often we assert what we think are our rights. This is mine. I'm going to take it by force. It's very stark contrast to how Abraham and Isaac's modern-day descendants have dealt with the people who live in this land today. This is ours. We're going to take it, no matter what. Both Abraham and Isaac, however, simply made peace. They moved on, and they trusted God to give them the land in His timing. It's God's promise. God will take care of it when He's ready and in His way. It says, so Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water that had been dug in the days of Abraham, his father, which the Philistines had stopped after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the names that his father gave them. So we've seen before how important wells were in Abraham's life in that dry and arid climate. If you've got animals, if you've got crops, you have to get water from somewhere. So the king had previously given Abraham permission to use this land. But since that time, Abraham had moved on, Isaac had moved on, and the local shepherds had come in and filled in all of Abraham's wells. It was sort of their way of saying, Abraham no longer has claim to this land. But Isaac returns, he digs them out, starts using them again. He's effectively asserting his rights, especially by reviving the names that Abraham had given them. If you remember, this is something that goes all the way back to Genesis 2. Naming something in this culture means you're asserting authority over it. Because of God's blessing, Isaac's flocks and herds grow. It seems to be all right for a while, but as things grow, they start expanding. They cover a larger area, so naturally Isaac starts digging new wells, or his men start digging new wells. And intentionally or not, that made a statement to the shepherds that he was claiming more land. And they didn't like that. And this again links Isaac. It parallels Abraham's experience. The narrator of the story describes his conflict with the shepherds of Gerar in almost exactly the same language that he used in describing the conflict between Abraham and Lot. You remember, Abraham had lots of flocks and herds. Lot had lots of flocks and herds, and they were bumping into each other. And their men started fighting and arguing. Exactly the same thing starts happening here. God's people have been promised the land, but it's not theirs, and they're being restricted. So as Abraham experienced that shortage of pasture land, so does Isaac. Look at verses 19 and 20. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they contended with him. He moves on, rather than get in a fight, but this happens a second time. He digs a second well. He gets in a dispute. He calls it sitna, which means opposition. But a third well goes undisputed. It says, so he called its name Rehoboth, saying, for now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. So rather than getting into a fight, he moves on until God establishes him peacefully. So Isaac acknowledges God's provision here. He could have gone to war, but he didn't. It was apparently in Isaac's power to seize those disputed lands and wells. Even Abimelech was afraid of him, but instead he moves on until God provides. As Abraham had been a peacemaker with Lot, remember going up on the mountain looking out, which land do you want? Abraham made peace with his nephew, so Isaac makes peace with these men, and he leaves himself in God's hand to be taken care of. Now, thinking back to Abraham and Lot, do you remember what took place immediately after Abraham and Lot separated? That's a harder question. God came to Abraham and renewed his promises. And following the same pattern, having peacefully resolved his conflict over the land, Isaac is now visited by God, who renews his promises. Verses 23 to 25. From there, Isaac went up to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. So again, the promises. God had made them to Abraham. They're now confirmed as promises to Isaac. And for the third time, we're told that God blessed Isaac, who, again, following the example of his father, he responds to God's blessing and God's revelation and promise of the covenant. He responds by building an altar and worshiping God. Now, finally, in verses 26 to 33, we see a final parallel between the life of Isaac and the life of Abraham. Abimelech seems to have heard about the disputes over Isaac's wells. So he arrives at Isaac's camp. He comes with Phicol, the commander of his army, and he comes with another guy with the name Ahuzath, who it said is his advisor. If we look at that word and how it's used, it's probably a guy who served as like an agricultural minister. He would oversee grazing and pasture rights, and he actually would have had his own little police force to go out and enforce these things in the land. So Abimelech comes with his chief army guy and his chief agricultural guy, who's probably heard about these disputes. He's coming to see what he can do. Now, they didn't come, it says, with any force of men, so they seem to have come peacefully, but Isaac's suspicious. In that culture, the demand would have been for Isaac to meet him, to meet the king Abimelech with a great feast. Think back to how Abraham even greeted these strangers. It was the messenger from God, but Abraham greeted those strangers by laying out a royal spread. That's what Isaac normally would have done, but he's suspicious. The feast only comes after they've settled matters here. So Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you? What are you doing here? I thought I left." They said, "We see plainly that the Lord is with you." They seem to see God more at work than Isaac does, in a sense. "So we said, let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm. Just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace, you are now the blessed of the Lord." So Isaac made them a feast, and they ate and drank. In the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths, and Isaac sent them on their way, and they departed from him in peace. So again, it's like a ditto of the Abraham story. Just as the previous Abimelech had recognized God's hand on Abraham, this Abimelech recognizes God's hand on Isaac. At the same time, the storyteller stresses that just as Abraham had been the source of the previous Abimelech's blessing, so Isaac has become a source of blessing to this Abimelech. Remember, by you all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. It played out in Abraham's life, even in a small scale, and now it's playing out in Isaac's life. like father, like son. And then the section ends with a short note, verses 32 and 33, about another well. It says, that same day Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug and said to him, "We have found water." That's really good news. Isaac called it Sheba, therefore, because the name of the city, is Beersheba to this day. So Sheba means oath. That's why the story is put here. He'd just sworn this oath with Abimelech. They were at peace. They sort of recognized each other. And so he names the new well after what had happened. And Isaac connected the blessing of the well with the blessing of God, his continued provision. So it wasn't just a water in a dry land, but God is taking care of him. And he's giving him a peaceful existence with these people. So with verse 34, we get back into the account of Esau and Jacob. We'll pick that up next time. But as I said when we started, the reason that the storyteller here in Genesis puts this collage, this collection of Isaac stories, into the middle of Esau and Jacob's story is important. And this is sort of the take-home part of this. So we've already seen how these Isaac stories, or you should be seeing as we read through these, how these Isaac stories show us the continuity of God's covenant promises. What he had promised to Abraham, he had also promised to Isaac. What he did for Abraham to fulfill his promises, God also does for Isaac. So these Isaac stories remind us that when God makes a promise, he always keeps it. And this is why Isaac's story is suddenly interposed into the middle of Esau and Jacob's story. Think about where we left off. This comes just after we've seen the character of these two young men, these two brothers. We've seen Esau sell his birthright to Jacob for a pot of soup. Now, Esau's birthright, as we discussed that last time, Esau's birthright represents God's covenant promises. But the last we saw of Esau, he blew it off because he was hungry. He blew it off for that red stuff. He didn't even know what it was. He just wanted something in his stomach. We were told the narrator's judgment on Esau was that he despised his birthright. He put no value on the things of God. The covenant is not in good hands with Esau. But now he's passed the things of God on to Jacob. And we say, Jacob values the things of God enough that he's plotted and schemed to get this birthright. And yet, if we look at the way he acquired it, practically stealing it from his brother, taking advantage of what he knew were his brother's weaknesses and character flaws, thinking only of today, we see that Jacob valued God's blessing, but he had no grasp of what it meant. Jacob understood the "I'll bless you" part, but he could not wrap his head around. He couldn't begin to understand the "walk before me and be blameless" obligation that it entailed. And so we're left wondering. The covenant has gone from Abraham. It's been passed through Isaac, and apparently it came through okay, and now it got to Jacob and Esau. It's the third generation, and we wonder if this third generation is going to run this venture of faith into the ground. God's covenant looks like it's in jeopardy. And so the storyteller gives us this interlude. As he tells us about Isaac, what he's really doing is reminding us of all the obstacles, all the character flaws, all the shortcomings, all the people and things that have stood in the way of God's covenant in the past, and showing us how God has removed every one of them. He's showing us how God grew the faith of both Abraham and Isaac through these events. God did it once with Abraham, he did it a second time with Isaac, and the fact that Abraham and Isaac's stories run so parallel points to the fact that this is God doing it. It's not just happening by chance. God has seen his covenant promises through both these men, through all these events, and in doing that, the storyteller is giving us hope in light of these two jerks who have had the covenant fall in their lap. If God was faithful in transmitting the covenant promises and blessings from Abraham to Isaac, and through all of Abraham's problems and all of Isaac's problems, God will be faithful in transmitting those same promises and blessings to the next generation and through the next generation, overcoming any new obstacles and character flaws that crop up so that the promises and blessings can be transmitted to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. Isaac parallels Abraham to show us that God is being intentional here. And that gives us hope. That even though these two guys are clueless and don't value it, even though they're not really walking with God, God is going to bring them through. Or at least he'll bring one through. He brings both through. That's getting ahead of the story. So, in this sense, the story has an even wider application. These stories were important for the Jews who heard them first, probably telling them around their campfires with their children in the wilderness after they fled from Egypt. God's promises for them were real. They had every reason to believe that God would lead them through the wilderness and give them possession of that land that he had promised to Abraham and to Isaac. And for the Jews who were in exile in Babylon, it was during those years that their rabbis or whomever it was pulled these stories together and edited them and masterfully wove this tapestry that we have in these early books of the Bible. They put them together as they were seeking an answer. Why are we in Babylon? Why was Jerusalem destroyed? Why was our country wiped out by Babylonians? Why are we here? And so they pulled together the story, and as they did that, they saw the answer. And so these stories were important for them. Abraham and Isaac encouraged them with the knowledge that God is faithful to his promises. They could understand. We rebelled and God has removed us temporarily. But through our faith, when we turn back to God, he will return us to the land of promise. And brothers and sisters, these stories ought to be encouraging reminders to us too. God's promises to us are just as good as his promises to Abraham and Isaac. Everything that he has promised us through Jesus Christ will come to pass. When we struggle through hard times, when we deal with temptation and sin, when we struggle and fail and fall into sin, we can know that God is standing by us, that he will care for us. He's the great promise keeper, if you will. And as our gospel today reminds us, he is the good shepherd. He's the good shepherd, in fact, who laid down his life for us, for his sheep. And in response, let us hear his voice. And in faith, let us follow him in faithful and loving obedience. Just as Abraham did, just as Isaac did, just as all these other saints of God who have walked before us have. Let us walk with him and trust, because he has been faithful in the past, we know that he will be faithful today and in the future.